Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hi, I'm John McEnroe.
I'm Bjorn Borg.
This is Martina Navratilova.
I'm Mats Wilander.
I'm Stan Wawrinka.
I'm Leighton Hewitt.
I'm Andy Murray.
And you're listening to the Tennis Podcast.
Hello and welcome to the Tennis Podcast, brought to you in association with The Telegraph and with Eurosport on the eve of the conclusion. In fact, not the eve. The eve means the night before, doesn't it? It's the evening after the conclusion of the events in Montreal and Toronto, the ATP and WTA events respectively. And it's been a very exciting, intriguing week on both fronts. David and I have been watching from faraway shores in Solihull and London, haven't we, David?
We have. And yeah, it's been a really interesting week. We've just seen the finals today. So yeah, I mean, there's a lot to talk about. Obviously, we sort of joined the tournament, didn't we, halfway through, because it was Wednesday when we did our last tennis podcast. And we had Denis Shapovalov as a talking point. We had Alexander Zverev as a talking point. Those two strands of conversation have continued significantly. And here we are just 10 minutes ago, Alexander Zverev beating Roger Federer in the final with a pretty spectacular performance from his side of the court and a pretty worrying looking Roger Federer on his side of the court. What did you make of it?
Yeah, I mean, well, are we going to delve into it now, David? That's a big old question. So we are about 20 minutes hence of the men's final in Montreal, Sasha Zverev defeating Roger Federer, and we're about what, 2 or 3 hours hence of the women's final in Toronto, Alina Svitolina defeating Caroline Wozniacki, aren't we? So a little bit more time to digest that one than the Zverev victory. Which one would you like to address first, David?
Well, given that it's so fresh in the mind and so, I don't know, intriguing, that final between Zverev and Federer. I mean, for a start, you could simplistically say that it reminded me of some of the baton passing type moments of previous years, of Safin smashing through against Sampras in 2000, Del Potro belting Federer off the court in the 2009 final at the US Open. This was a similar level performance, I thought, from Zverev. I mean, I've often watched him and I've sort of engaged with the hype and sort of been interested in watching him play as a result of it, but kind of tried to work out what all the fuss was about. You know, he's 6'7" tall, but he doesn't have the forehand of Del Potro.
6'6", isn't he?
6'6". Is he? All right, 6'6".
Yeah, I know you're into, as I know tall men are, exaggerating their height by an inch or two. But I believe he's 6'6".
With him in particular, I also like to make sure, I'm quite glad you interrupted and said 6'6", because I quite like to be just that little bit taller than these tennis players. So
I'm sure when I first met you, you were 6'6", though. Just like a few years ago, my brother was 6'5", and suddenly he's six foot six. Yeah.
Yeah. I'm still growing.
And do you remember Ivo Karlovic used to be 6'10", and Isner was 6'9". And then Isner bumped himself up to 6'10", and now all of a sudden, yeah, Karlovic is 6'11". Funny.
Well, when
that.
Somebody comes along, you know, who starts to threaten your level, you just add a bit, is the way I do it.
Sure.
Which is kind of what the tennis players do. Roger Federer has been adding bits to his game, hasn't he, for years? But Zverev today, And throughout the week, actually, showed, I think, why he is such a big deal. I think this is his fifth title of the year. But if you take it back to when he played Richard Gasquet, and he was clearly not feeling great out there. Neither was Gasquet, for that matter. It was a pretty scratchy performance from Zverev. Goes match point down and wins it with a 49-stroke rally, where he is just blasting the ball, but in a controlled manner. That's what I love about watching the guy. He plays powerful, assertive tennis, but he does it in this rhythmical kind of way where it's all under control. He's not stretching himself. He's playing within himself, and that's what makes him exciting. It's like watching a big Djokovic, and that was what he did today against Federer. He made Federer look a little bit like he's looked for a couple of years against Novak Djokovic when Djokovic was at his best. But at the same time, I mean, that's what happened for the first set of the final today. The second set was a non-event because Roger Federer was injured. He's got a problem.
But hang on a second. He didn't suddenly develop that problem in the second set, did he? Look, I don't want to take anything away from Sasha Zverev. I think in terms of the final, I don't think we've learned that much. We knew Zverev was the real deal. I watched a lot of him in Washington last week and I thought, this guy can win the US Open. I now still very much think this guy can win the US Open. I probably thought that before Washington, frankly. I just feel that even more strongly now. So in terms of sort of take home from that, it's not like Shapovalov, who will very much come on to in due course. We knew about Zverev, and he was awesome today in the final. And it is one of those finals where you don't know how much of how Federer played was about the pressure, the constant pressure he was put under from Zverev, which, as you've described, is sort of Djokovic-esque, but a bit more even. The sort of consistent pressure is Djokovic-esque, but he's got an additional dimension on top of that. And also there's the additional factor of Federer. I don't know. We haven't heard from him yet. I'm sure he'll be coming to press in Montreal any second now. He's too sportsmanlike, I think, to give away too much about how he is physically. And I know speculation has been that the physical issue he has is with his back, which is very much a sort of chronic ongoing thing rather than an immediate recent acute injury. But to me, looked about 75% today. If I had to attempt to put a figure on it, I would say Federer was at about 75% today. And in all honesty, let's face it, he hasn't looked himself quite all week, has he? He was woeful against Ferrer. He really was in the third round, I think that was. He was a lot better against Bautista Agut in the quarterfinals, but he's got this incredible record against Bautista Agut. He gives him the perfect ball. He's like a ball machine for Roger Federer. Ferrer. Well, yeah. I mean, exactly. But Ferrer gave him a far greater run for his money, though. I mean, Federer really was bad that day. I think it was Thursday against Ferrer. That was not good from Federer. And that was when the alarm bells started ringing. So I think, on reflection, I think great that he reached the final. I'd be very surprised if we didn't see a pullout from Cincinnati next week. The only possible thing that could provoke him into staying in the Cincinnati draw is how close he is to regaining the world number one title. He's in that tussle with Nadal, but Nadal very much in pole position for that, and I just don't see that as enough of a carrot for Federer in his current state to enter Cincinnati, although the conditions suit him there far better. You know, he hadn't played in Montreal for 6 years, and I did feel that he spent the whole week realizing why he hadn't played in Montreal for 6 years. But I've just spent a long time talking about Roger Federer, and I probably should have been talking about Sasha Zverev. The only reason I'm not is because Sasha Zverev being the real deal, being amazing, being a Grand Slam contender, not news anymore. You know, an email came through to me from the ATP earlier today. You would have got the same one. You know, media mailing list received an email confirming that Alexander Zverev had qualified for the next gen finals in Milan. And I just thought, I mean, that's sweet, but so completely by the by now. I mean, he is going to qualify for London. He is going to be, injury aside, a top 10, probably top 10, top 5 player now for the next decade.
Wonder if he'll play both.
I know that he can. I would be very, very surprised, personally. I think he might show up to both. I think there might be some pressure on him or some encouragement to him to go to Milan to show his support for the event as the talisman for it. But I can't personally see him playing in it because he can win London. He can absolutely win the World Tour Finals in London. So in his position, why would you do anything to jeopardise your perfect preparations for London? And I'm not sure playing in Milan would be the best preparations. But I think there's a good chance he might go and show support for the event.
Yeah, a couple of things. I think Zverev, I do feel differently even within this week that he's shown me something else, personally. I think the way he fought his way through that Gasquet match, and it was like that was the moment. He looked a bit sorry for himself throughout that match. He looked like he was going to lose. That rally itself, you had Gasquet just refusing to give him a bailout ball, just making him play every single ball, these little forehand slices, just dollying the ball over, just tempting him. Come on, Alex, hit it hard, a miss. Come on, you know you want to. Go for the line. And he refused to. And that seemed to me to encapsulate what he's all about. He keeps his composure when he's under the most extreme pressure. And to then defeat Shapovalov in front of the young kid's home crowd, and then to come out against Federer. He said a quite funny little line on Sky just now in the interview there. They asked him whether he was intimidated against Federer. He said, well, I tried to act like I wasn't. And I don't believe him, personally. I don't think he was intimidated in the slightest.
No, I didn't believe him either.
I think he comes out thinking he can beat everybody, and that's what makes him such an exciting player. I think from Federer's standpoint, the only way he will play Cincinnati, in my opinion, is if this was, say, a back spasm and it passes just in 24 hours and he feels absolutely fine. Unless he's 100%, there's no way, in my view, he will bother playing Cincinnati because, you know, he's remodeled his whole schedule and career, hasn't he, over the last 12 months to I'm only going to play when I feel good.
What, David, do you think made him play Montreal in the first place? Given that probably the baseline for him was to think, I will play one of Montreal or Cincinnati, because that's what he's done in recent years. And he's been even more prudent with his schedule this year and last year than before that. And he's always played so, so well in Cincinnati. Cincinnati is deemed to have the conditions most similar to the US Open. I know that Cincinnati suits the family really well. They've traditionally always got a house nearby because it's a lot sort of, it's not rural, it is kind of in a city, but it's quite easy to just rent a big house and have the whole family there. And generally it's just suited him. In every which way, Cincinnati has suited him. So why this year did he choose to play Montreal?
I think two reasons. One is I do think that the number one ranking came into his head. He suddenly realised, wow, I really am close here. And why not? I could basically seal it pretty much if I win Montreal. I think there was a bit of that.
Whoa, hang on, no, because he didn't know Nadal was going to lose early to Zverev.
No. But what I'm saying is he was going to close the gap even closer, so to make it almost a foregone conclusion eventually that he would get that number one ranking. And I still think he will at some point, as long as he's fit enough to play these next few weeks at some point. I think there may be there's been a bit more about Federer wanting to play events that he's not played before or not played too much before, and he hasn't played Montreal a huge amount.
Or not won before.
Yeah, well,
is
exactly.
That it? Is it about...
No, I don't think so. I think it was the number one ranking was what inspired him. But I also, my guess is, even though he hasn't really looked that great all tournament, I think when he made the decision to go to Montreal, I don't think he was injured at all. I think at that stage, he probably felt, great, I'm the Wimbledon champion. I feel fantastic. You know, let's just keep this rolling. And then I think something has happened probably in Montreal.
Well, we know the back is a sort of chronic, ongoing issue, don't
but
we?
But he's not felt it all year, has
no,
he?
No, he hasn't. That he has occasional flare-ups of and that he has to manage. Mm. It sounds to me like Murray's hip issue is the same. There does seem to be a bit of a trend for these ongoing chronic conditions developing later in career that the players just have to find a way to manage. He looked rattled and irritated, didn't he, Federer? And we're guessing as to how much that was rattled and irritated at his body letting him down, and rattled and irritated at what was coming at him from the other end of the court. I suspect an almost 50-50 mixture of the two. For sure, I mean, the fact that he reached the final, for sure, Roger Federer is so good and so good this year that even a, let's say, 75% fit, not entirely happy, not playing his best Roger Federer would have beaten almost anybody today. Zverev still had to be really, really good, and he beat Roger Federer comprehensively. I mean, Sasha Zverev is, I mean, to say he's the real deal feels completely redundant now. You know, watching his semi-final with Shapovalov, who I'm so endlessly excited about. I feel like I'm going to burst. You know, he was the sort of boring, functional establishment player by comparison, wasn't he? Standing on the court with Shapovalov, he was the establishment, which is very strange because he's 20 years old. And he, when he won the title in Rome, he was like the young upstart. He wasn't the young upstart this week. Okay, he's young, but he's been around for a while now. Everyone's known about him for a while. I know that he is.
It's been incremental, Catherine. It's been incremental with Zverev. He hasn't just had this extraordinary breakout result the way that Kyrgios did beating Nadal at Wimbledon, the way that I mentioned Safin winning the US Open at age 20. Now, maybe Zverev will do the same. But it hasn't been quite. And let one thing I would say, and the caveat has to be about this, he hasn't done it at slams yet. This guy has not gone beyond the quarterfinals of a Grand Slam tournament.
No, absolutely not. And there are parallels there with Svitolina, who we'll come on to talk about shortly.
Yeah, there are. There are, for sure. And that's, you know, there was a good debate going on Twitter as to whether you could consider Zverev as the favourite for the US Open. Well, no, you can't, in my view at least. Not. It's a best of five set format. This is where it really matters. This is where people peak. And this guy has not got beyond the quarterfinals. He lost to Milos Raonic, who was well short of his best at Wimbledon a few weeks ago. And there's no reason why that might not happen again, because if he runs into a big server or Marin Cilic or someone like that, Zverev is going to have to play like he did today, because he would have beaten just about anybody today. I think Federer would have had to be at his best to win today.
Agreed.
The way
yeah.
Zverev was playing.
Or close to. Yeah, absolutely. Best or close to. And let's not forget, he came into the French Open. You know, he's as good a clay court player as hard court player, or certainly as comfortable on the clay as on the hard. And he went into the French Open as the Rome champion, as, you know, Nadal aside, a genuine contender. And he lost first round there. I know it was a horrible draw for Dasco, but he lost first round, and that's the bottom line. So that does put a seed of doubt in our minds.
Some of these people players.
I'm not going to take this comment any further, because we're going to buy ourselves a week before we have to try and embark on this topic. But just broaching the subject of favourites for the US Open is sort of a ridiculous minefield this year.
Today's result, as well.
There aren't any.
I mean, let's be honest.
I feel like, you know, I could put in a late request for a wild card, and you know, it feels like anything can happen.
4 days ago, though, when we did the last podcast on Wednesday, if we'd have had this discussion, it wouldn't have gone further than saying Roger Federer for either one of us, would it?
Whoa! I would have put him as the favourite, but not as strong a favourite as I put him for Wimbledon, not as head and shoulders above everybody else. But I would have perhaps been struggling for strong. I know you really wanted to put Nadal in the same bracket as Federer, and perhaps you you still do, although Federer might now be in a slightly lower bracket than he was a week ago. I mean, it's such a, the sands are so shifting beneath us. I personally have my queries over Nadal at the US Open at this stage of his career personally. That doesn't mean he won't do it, though. I'm not counting him out at all. Just for me, he's not a strong favourite to do anything, but nobody is. Absolutely, yeah, nobody is. I mean, Zverev, aside from his Grand Slam record, is as close to a favourite for it as really anybody is getting at the moment. But look, I didn't mean to open the can of worms because I think we need to buy ourselves a week. We need to buy ourselves a Cincinnati week before we properly have ourselves this discussion.
I've screwed the can top back on.
Yeah, please do. There are other big stories, happenings, moments from Montreal that we should probably touch upon. Shapovalov is the biggest.
Yeah.
Semi-finalist, victories over Del Potro, Nadal, Mannarino. I know in terms of ranking and stature, he doesn't come into the same category as Del Potro and Nadal. However, for me, that victory was in many ways the most impressive. Coming back from beating Nadal, I did commentary on that match for ATP Tennis Radio, and at the start of it I was on with Miles McLagan, and I read him a list of names, and I have to say I stole the list of names from Student Matt, who tweeted this, so thank you, Student Matt, for providing me with some of my excellent research for my commentary. I gave him a list of names and I said, what do these people have in common? It was that they were all fantastic players, but they had all caused huge upsets over Rafael Nadal and they'd lost their next match. You know, Gilles Muller was in there, Fernando Verdasco, Fabio Fognini, Dustin Brown, Lucas Russell. Yeah, these guys. It happens, doesn't it? And it's not just upsets over Nadal. Typically, when you cause a huge upset, you lose the next match, generally speaking, especially when it's a young player who's inexperienced at dealing with everything that comes with a big victory. So I was so immensely impressed with how he beat Mannarino, an incredibly tricky player, a player that requires maturity to beat. That was what was most impressive, especially as he was absolutely killed in the first set. He was 4-love down. He was about to go 5-love down. He looked like he was going to lose that first set 6-love and sink without trace. And lo and behold, he comes back and wins it. And I was completely blown away. He is, as I say, he made Sasha Zverev, until this week, the most exciting young talent on the ATP World Tour. He made him look boring and pedestrian. That is the explosiveness and the excitement of Denis Shapovalov. He has some development to do, but 18, and he's not even nearly 19, he only turned 18 in April. 18, in modern tennis terms, is so young. Is so, yeah. So young. The days of Boris Becker winning Wimbledon at 17, they're over. And just the prospect of what he will be in 2 years is mouth-watering for tennis.
Well,
it really is.
If he can continue to develop the way he has burst on the scene over the last 12 months, I mean, I'd never seen him play until Canada last year when he beat Kyrgios in a match where Kyrgios was throwing in a pretty poor effort. And you could see the flamboyant talent of the kid, but he was... the difference is extraordinary in 12 months. And this week, I actually see the parallels with what I talked about with Zverev, how his arc has taken place of improvement. And that match about you mentioned of Mannarino, I do feel that was almost more significant than the Nadal win, because it's so difficult coming back out, backing it up, everybody expecting you to deliver, going 4-love down against a really clever, difficult opponent.
As tricky as they come, definitely.
Yeah,
exactly, the guy you don't want to play the day after a victory like he had over Nadal. Exactly the guy you don't want to play.
In both the Nadal and Mannarino matches, I fell asleep after the first set. And on both occasions, I could not believe that I woke up and found out that he'd won either one of those matches, because the way it was going, it just seemed so unlikely. So, you know, and then I watched them back after the event, and he is such an exciting player. I tweeted Darren Cahill, who was talking about him and saying what an exciting player he is, and I said, doesn't he remind you of somebody you used to coach? about 15 years ago. Because
talking about Agassi?
Leighton Hewitt. And not only does he... I mean, I know he plays very differently to him.
Oh,
but
come
his
on.
Look... The
just because he's got long blonde hair and a backwards baseball cap?
No, they look similar. They react similarly to winning points, to
a bit
situations.
Spunky. Come on, David.
How many more things do you want to have as a comparison? I mean, you know, he was showing incredible guts under difficult conditions. He was firing himself up in the spotlight of all the crowd. He looks like him. He's got the back to front cap. He's got the long blonde hair.
No.
He's got the freckles. He looks exactly like him. Put them side by side. Look at the physical reactions after winning points.
What, fist pumping?
Yeah.
That's... Well, no, I'm not denying the comparisons that you're drawing. I just think they could be drawn with lots of people. I wear a backwards.
Yeah,
I've got long blonde hair, fist bump, and have a backwards baseball cap.
Post a picture.
To be honest, the fact of drawing comparisons is an interesting talking point because I was struggling. I was struggling to find anyone to compare him to. He's that explosive. And when I saw him against Nadal, I didn't realise he had the stamina that he had in that match. I didn't realise he had the footwork that he displayed in that match. I didn't realise he had the mental toughness. You know, he was serving second in that. Oh, no, he was serving first, but he faced break points in pretty much every game of that deciding set, and it just had the feel of it of kind of exactly the match he played at Queens against Thomas Burdick, you know, won over everyone in the stadium, caused a huge stir, would be the talking point regardless of whether he won the match, and it just felt like it was going to be that match again at Queens against Burdick, and it wasn't. He won. He was 3-love down in the deciding set tiebreak, and again it just had that feel of it, and that would have been just fine. A lot of players would have taken that. A lot of players would have taken, I'm 18 years old, I gave this Canadian crowd the time of their lives, I'm still going to be on the telly tonight and tomorrow because I've taken Nadal, my childhood hero, to a deciding set tiebreak. But that wasn't enough for him. He had to win it. And that is what distinguishes these guys that are going to make it, touch wood, from the ones who don't quite. If he doesn't make it, then something awful has intervened and happened, because he is something. He really is something. And people will tune in to watch him play tennis. Absolutely. You cannot take your eyes off him playing tennis.
Yeah.
I mean, you fell asleep after the first set, but others gone.
Yeah, well, I had an alarm call about 4 hours later from my kids waking up.
That doesn't usually stop you, though, David. That stops me. It doesn't usually stop you.
Getting old,
getting
grey.
This is what I've got to look forward to.
Yeah, you have. But the other thing is about him is there's a lot made of his backhand, understandably so, because of the flourish of it. It's so extravagant, etc. But it's actually... So the revelation for me was how many devastating forehand winners he was hitting against Nadal. He had more than double the winners on the forehand side than Nadal had. He had over 30 of them, and slapping them.
I agree. I mean, so many revelations. But I mean, yes, I know the backhand has been talked about since that victory over Kyrgios in Toronto last year. But he hits single-handed backhand winners with neither foot touching the ground. I know we saw Rios and Safin and Ferrero sort of trademark that jump double-handed backhand winner, but I've never really seen a single-hander do it. It's something I wouldn't think it was sort of physiologically possible, but apparently it is. And his willingness to approach the net, even though his volleys are so unpolished at the moment, but it's all there. You know, he knows the only way I'm going to get better at volleying is to throw myself up to the net and see what happens. And in light of the comments Federer made after Wimbledon about how sad he was that he thought tennis was getting a bit more one-dimensional because young players coming up weren't willing to volley and put themselves in those kind of situations. He's like the antidote to that, isn't he? I mean, everything about him was, I'm, as you can tell, I'm in the fan club.
I think you are.
I am. I'm 100% in the fan club. But I think the one other thing we need to talk about from Montreal before we move on to talk about Toronto and the WTA event is Nick Kyrgios. The hotly billed match against Denis Shapovalov. Not even the match, really. The fact that we saw him competing in a hotly billed match, a hugely looked forward to match, and he wasn't really physically able to compete. And I'm now struggling to remember the last time I watched him play when he was 100% at his physical best. And I'm sort of thinking, has he ever been at his 100% physical best since,
in
you
March.
Know, since...
In March,
yeah,
and that's it.
Yeah, but
in
it
Indian
was
Wales
brief, wasn't it? I agree. I mean, that match against Federer probably still stands out as my best of the year, but it was a brief spell, wasn't it?
Oh, yeah, for sure. And look, it's depressing to watch him struggle physically and also mentally and emotionally. It is depressing seeing somebody who just can't deliver their best. And it does make me wonder whether he should just call it a year. I know that sounds extreme.
You've put that out a lot on Twitter, and suddenly in tennis, everybody is starting to think that just calling it quits halfway through the season is the answer to things. And hey, it might be. It was for Federer. And it
has been for Sloane Stephens.
That was...
Who came
come
out
on.
Fresh and she's reached the semi-finals
hang,
in Toronto.
Hang on,
in
David. Her foot was in a cast for
no,
months.
No, I'm not saying she deliberately did it. I'm saying that she's come back out,
yeah, but
missing
hang,
the
well,
sport,
yeah, but
wishing she was playing it, and now...
You're conflating different issues. You're talking
no,
about somebody taking an active decision that they could carry on playing, but they're deciding not to.
No, I'm not doing... Look, yes, she,
Sloane
that was
Stephens,
enforced upon her.
Sloane
was
Stephens
in, I
was
agree.
In a cast. She could not physically play tennis,
but
and she would
somebody,
have been there playing tennis had she not been in a cast.
Yeah, looking as though she'd rather be somewhere else. Suddenly, she's had a
well,
period out of the game.
That. You don't know
come,
that.
Well, Catherine, I've got 4 years' worth of evidence of it. I've got 4 years of watching Sloane Stephens looking, frankly, as if she'd rather be somewhere else
I,
a lot of the time.
I agree. I, it's been great for Sloane Stephens. I'm saying this is a completely different kettle of fish that we're talking about here.
I'm saying that if Nick Kyrgios were to take a period out of the game to get his body feeling right, and at the same time to miss the sport and think,
yeah, but it depends
it
what he does in that time,
again?
Doesn't it? What would he do in that time? Would
he
hire a proper fitness trainer and go to the gym every day and start doing Pilates? You know, Murray's been posting these. Because I don't at the moment believe that he would. If he would, then yeah, maybe. But
no, look, I may be wrong, but what I do know is he's pulled out of three tournaments in a row, right, mid-match. He's come into Montreal. He's played three or four games against Alexander Zverev. He's looked like he's hurting, and the body language goes, and he starts laughing sarcastically at his own inability to play properly because of his body.
I don't... And yeah, but okay, but tell me somebody over the age of 25 that wouldn't benefit from a load of time off then coming back fresh.
Well,
the season's
yeah, but
too long, isn't it? I mean, that kind of applies to everyone.
But isn't that the point I've been making all along over the last few weeks, that what happened to Federer, and I know he's not the first player it's ever happened to, he decided to, because of injury, cut his season short. The associated benefit was that he came out up for it, feeling good again physically, got rid of all those little extra injuries and niggles that he'd been suffering from, came out, missed the game, loving it, and goes and does what he's done.
Yeah, no, that's well documented. Everybody knows.
Yeah, but... and I'm saying that Sloane Stephens was forced to take a break from the circuit, and she's come out looking as though she doesn't want to waste her career. And I'm saying that Nick Kyrgios might benefit from going away from it all and realising, actually, this is pretty bloody good, isn't it? And
hang
now
on.
I feel
he could
physically
not miss,
okay
hang
again.
On. He could not miss it, though. He could not miss it.
How do you know?
How do you know that he would?
I don't, but
well,
I'm
exactly.
just saying
that's what,
my theory.
I mean, okay, but I feel like that theory is just based on the fact that Federer did it, and Nadal, you know,
No, it isn't.
So, who wouldn't,
you, no,
who
another
wouldn't
example.
Benefit from
I've
it?
I've just said Sloane Stephens benefited from it, albeit not intentionally going off the
circuit. Who over the age of 25 wouldn't benefit from that? The season's too, and, well, and then we just come back
know.
To the season's too
not
long.
Not everybody's the same,
being,
are they?
Being fresh.
Not everybody is this built.
Okay,
the
same. But I feel like you're. But you're using the evidence of other players to back up your theory and then saying everyone's different. And so it might work for Kyrgios, but
yeah,
what I'm saying is
just I
being
think
a
he
bit
should
stale
do that.
And being mentally sort of unable to cope with the rigors, physical and mental of the tour. You know, just going, okay, I'll pack it in for 6 months then. It's not really the answer because those physical and mental rigors are still going to be there when you get back. So every year you're going to be someone that only plays 6 months of the
Look,
year?
He may have the sort of body that never copes with the tennis circuit. He may have that. He may never put in the work that is required in order to physically build up his body to cope with what is required on the circuit. My view is, what he's doing right now is not working. Going week to week,
oh, I'd certainly
playing,
agree with that. Yeah,
playing these events. Oh, you know,
it's
I'll
not
clock
the playing
in, I'll
the
play
events,
the
though,
match.
David. It's what he's doing off the court.
Well, maybe that may well be the case. I'm just saying. I think he could
he's
do it going away.
He's not playing that much
and,
tennis.
And
he's
rebooting.
Losing first round, and you know, it's not the on court matches that are costing him at the moment. It's what he's doing off the court. I believe.
Exactly. So, yeah, look, my six months off isn't just him going and putting his feet up and playing computer games for
yeah,
the next
but if
6 months.
Doesn't
yes,
have
you'd have
but
to
if
do
he doesn't
something.
Have the discipline or the mindset or whatever it is, I don't know. And I caveat this with I'm sympathetic with Nick Kyrgios potentially not being cut out for the mental and physical rigours of life on tour. Not everybody is. I wouldn't be. It's blooming tough. If that's the case, I'm very, very sympathetic. However, we're a tennis podcast. We talk about the tennis tour and, you know, we have to be frank about these things. And I don't believe it's playing the matches that is costing Nick Kyrgios. I think it's the decisions he's making away from the court. And
I don't disagree with
maybe
you for
they're,
a moment.
They're likely sort of necessitated by his character and personality. There are positive upsides to it. The fact that he invited people to come and hit with him, that's the positive side of it, isn't it? The fact that he's unorthodox and can't do it the normal way and can't do the grind of it, needs to make it fun and different and interesting. Though that's the positive side to that. The negative side is that he's probably not doing the hours of Pilates and stuff that Andy Murray is doing to leave no stone unturned to try and get his body desperately fit for the US Open. And I'm not sure that would change with a few months off. Look, it might, but I'm not hugely convinced. And if it does work, maybe that would just work for everyone. Maybe we all just need to. Maybe tennis just needs to have 6 months off.
No, I don't. That's not what I'm saying at all. For a second,
I'm
watching a guy.
I'm being facetious, go, David.
I'm watching a guy go week to week and looking as though he can't play a match without feeling injured. Now, I think he needs to go away and reboot and do something about it.
I was doing a joke to try and lighten the mood.
Okay.
You missed that, didn't you?
Yes.
Yes.
This Mother's Day, celebrate the extraordinary women in your life with a heartfelt gift from Blue Nile. Whether it's for your mom, a mother figure, or yourself as a mom, find that perfect piece to express your love and appreciation. Explore Blue Nile's exquisite pearls and mesmerizing gemstones that she's sure to love. Enjoy fast shipping options like guaranteed free shipping and returns. Make this Mother's Day unforgettable with a piece from Blue Nile. Right now, get up to 50% off at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Finding your perfect home was hard, but thanks to Burrow, furnishing it has never been easier. Burrow's easy-to-assemble modular sofas and sectionals are made from premium, durable materials, including stain and scratch-resistant fabrics. So they're not just comfortable and stylish, they're built to last. Plus, every single Burrow order ships free right to your door. Right now, get 15% off your first order at burrow.com/ACAST. That's 15% off at burrow.com/ACAST.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Should we talk about Toronto?
Let's do that.
Elena Svitolina won the title, defeating Caroline Wozniacki. That is the sixth final defeat for Wozniacki this year. We'll talk about that in a moment. We should kick off with talking about Elena Svitolina, who defeated Simona Halep in the semi-finals. And Chris Evert and Pam Shriver had some pretty harsh words about that match and about Simona Halep in the semi-final. They said, quote, "I'm speechless watching this match. It's awful. Never thought I'd see this kind of performance from a top player." That's Chris Evert and Pam Shriver talking about Halep, who was beaten by Svitolina, went on to win the final today. What are your thoughts on all of it? I've just hit you with all sorts of stuff. I've hit you with Svitolina being brilliant, with Wozniacki losing in finals, and with Halep being ripped into
Halep
by
first,
it's a lot.
The Halep thing first. I did read those quotes. I didn't see the match, so it's difficult to comment. I know that she played, I think, two matches in a day because of the rain.
She did, yeah.
That took place, and you know. Look, she is somebody who's got form as a player who at times does not give her best effort and can go through the motions and it'd be pretty frustrating to watch. That has happened a lot less recently since that that moment in Miami, I think it was, with Darren Cahill when he ended up leaving the camp for a while. So I feel a bit uncomfortable commenting because I didn't see the match. The other elements to it of Elena Svitolina, she has just, it's a very similar curve and arc to that of Zverev. Okay, Zverev's done it in maybe a shorter time frame, and because he was a teenager and now he's 20, it seems more spectacular. But actually, it's very similar. Incrementally, those two players have built their rankings and become quietly a massive threat to everybody, and Svitolina is beating on the regular WTA circuit. She's beating everybody that she comes up against more often than not. I think she's won more matches than anybody else this year. She's won more titles than anybody else this year. She's won some big finals as well, and yet there's still this massive question mark over her at the Grand Slams because she is beatable at the Slams. And there's a number of players like that. Pliskova is another one. I know she got to the final of the US Open last year, but she loses too many big matches at the Slams.
I would agree, but aren't there massive parallels to Pliskova this time last year, who hadn't done what she ended up doing at the US Open and had never been beyond the third round of a slam up until this point, and here she is as the world number one. I agree, she still has some more proving to do at slam level, that run to the final aside last year, but there are parallels there, aren't there?
There are. I think there's a lot of proving to be done by these players because they need to win one of these things now. That's what Kerber did, that's what Muguruza has done twice now as well. And, you know, we go into the US Open eventually, and I still feel, even though Svitolina came back to beat Muguruza from a set down, it's Muguruza I'd be looking to ahead of those other players because she is the big occasion player who's done it at the Slams, and she's got that big game. I don't know whether there's something that can help Svitolina reproduce at the Slams what she does week to week, or is it that when you get to the Slams, players that you're up against play at a different level? That's the other. I don't know which one of those two things it is.
I think it's more about Svitolina than the other factor. I can't rule out the other factor as having an impact, but I think it's more about Svitolina. I would agree with you about Muguruza. I mean, a Muguruza that's reaching quarters and semis of tour level events, as she has been doing this week in Toronto and last week in Stanford, that's a Muguruza that will step it up another couple of gears at a Grand Slam and probably be the favourite. Again, I'm going to defer the who's the favourite discussion for another week. But yes, she lost to Svitolina in the quarterfinal, but it was a very competitive match. And I'd say for her, a player who doesn't tend to do it week in, week out, the fact that she's reaching semis and quarters is enough going into a slam. Personally, that's how I feel. Yes, Halep did play the two matches in a day. She beat Caroline Garcia in the first the quarterfinal, and then she went on to lose to Svitolina. But so did Svitolina play the two matches in one day. She had played more sets. She beat Muguruza in three sets earlier on in the day in her quarterfinal, and then defeated Halep 1-1. I didn't see much of the match either, I must hold my hands up. So again, we can talk about the facts of what Everton Shriver have said and how that's been taken by viewers and on Twitter and everything. It's been applauded by many as sort of real honesty and heartfelt analysis. And from what I can tell, it's only coming from a period of sort of warmth and desperation for Halep to fulfil her potential, and losing as great a player as Svitolina is, losing 1-1 to her in a semi-final is not her potential, and retiring in the quarterfinal to Makarova last week in Washington doesn't feel like her potential to me, given that she's kind of the fittest player out there. So I don't know what's going on with
actually
Simona
that Washington one was quite interesting, because somebody criticised Halep for wearing, I think, all black.
Well, she wasn't given a
match.
Choice. Adidas have right. not produced a. So it's interesting. So they were giving that the male players had a white version of that kit. It's the same kit that Zverev has been wearing. For this hard court season. It's the black with the yellow trim. It's got quite a 70s vibe to it. I really like it. But the guys seem to have a light coloured version, and the women don't, as far as I can gather.
Well, Dan Cahill actually said, "You're right," in response to that criticism, and he said, "We'll make sure that does not happen again. We've spoken to her clothing supplier, and that will not be happening again. She will have an alternative outfit."
Yeah, it's very interesting.
So, yeah, it is.
Yeah, I mean, that's a pretty basic, fundamental thing, isn't it? To you don't want to be losing because your kit supplier is giving you something that you're roasting in. So the Halep thing. I don't know.
I do think she's a bit of an excuse finder. I think she has been over the years, and she's still yet to deliver a slam, even though she's so capable of winning one, and she's been in a couple of finals now. I think she'll crack it eventually, personally, especially if she continues listening to Darren Cahill. I do think she'll get there. Wozniacki, incidentally, very interesting one. Nick Whittaker said to us at Tennis
Great
Podcast.
Name. That Great she, name, Nick. She, although I did see that no on relation. Twitter, I think he's a double tier, isn't he?
What is he? Yeah, he is. He's
I think
a double
that
T.
is very
That's
much
right.
from
yeah.
a different clan. It's a rival Whittaker clan.
Yeah, well, okay, we'll allow it for now. But anyway, what we won't allow is what he said here, which is that Whittaker, she does not go into the US Open as the favourite.
Whittaker does not go into the US Open
in the view
as the
of
favourite
Whittaker.
For anything.
Best chance she'll get to win that first slam. Terrific form up until the finals.
I think that's how can I politely? I think that's nonsense. I think she, look, I'm not counting her out. I think she's in. With
I think
Constance's
much more likely. To
yeah,
win it
she's
than her.
She's not. There's no way Caroline Wozniacki is a favourite. I mean, aside from anything else, she's lost six finals this year,
and that's the
that's
thing.
A lot she, of finals.
She is, look, I don't want to be disrespectful in any way. This is a player who just keeps on putting herself out there. She's a great competitor. She's got to six finals. Let's be fair
yeah,
to her.
She's,
I wouldn't be.
Look, I have endless time for the tennis that she's playing. I still don't think it's best in the world tennis. I mean, no, she and Muguruza play their best. Muguruza knocks her off the court. But she's maximising again, which I have a lot of respect for.
Yeah, but there is a reason why she hasn't won a slam to this point, because, frankly, she does lack that extra gear. And yeah. players produce their best, and it's too much for her. That's what happens on the biggest stages, and that's what's happened over the course of her career.
Yeah, but look, she's in a pack of players who can't be counted out for sure. But I think to talk about her as the favourite is a stretch. I mean, to talk about anybody really as a favourite is a bit of a stretch. But again, I'm going to play the deferral card.
We've got another week. Yeah.
We've got another week, and goodness knows what's going to happen in that week, David. I mean, Cincinnati. What an enormous unknown it is on all fronts. Shall I be mean and just ask you to predict winners? Shall I do that? I can do that. Shall I? Who's going to win Cincinnati, David? For the men's and the women's.
Oh dear!
I know. I'm fully aware that's an almost impossible task. I don't see Zverev doing the back to back. Do you?
I think he could.
Yeah, he could.
Was
Andy Roddick the last to do that?
That sounds about right.
Andy Roddick, 2003, I think.
I think he could. Yeah, I mean, look.
And then he went on to win the US Open, of course. I think there's only three that have done it. It's Brad Gilbert, it's Andre Agassi, and it's Andy Roddick.
I was not expecting you to say Brad Gilbert.
I know. I'm recalling that stat from 15 years ago or whatever it was, 14 years ago, because at the time that Roddick did that, he was coached by Brad Gilbert.
Oh,
so
right.
I remember all the commentators saying, can he emulate what his coach did? But of course, Brad Gilbert then didn't go on to win the US Open. Andy Roddick did turn out to be his own slam. Anyway, only slam.
Catherine?
Yes.
I think we've only got about a minute left. Can I just tell you something before we go?
Is the something a prediction for Cincinnati?
Well, I tell you what, I'll go Zverev because, frankly, he does look like the best player in these three set matches at the moment.
I'd
go Svitolina.
So you're going to go Zverev and Svitolina?
Why not?
Neck on the block. Will Shapovalov be given a wild card? At the moment, he's scheduled to play a challenger event next week.
Crikey.
Yeah.
Well, he should be, shouldn't he? But I don't even know if you can.
I mean, the moment, there is a lot of question marks over whether he'll even get a US Open wildcard. At the moment, he's down to play qualies.
Well, obviously, he needs to get a US Open
wildcard. Hang on. Most people think he won't because it would mean sacrificing one for a US junior. In the same situation, would Wimbledon sacrifice a British junior's wildcard, for Shapovalov in exactly the same situation? I don't know. It's a big call.
Didn't they? Wimbledon gave him
the junior champion from the year before, and that's customary. So that's different.
I think after what's just happened, they probably would. Personally.
I would hope so. But reading what I've read over the past day or so, it doesn't seem as much of a given as I would have. I hope so, David. But doesn't sound like a given to me. Watch this space.
Okay. Anyway, so those are mine. Can I tell you my final little thing?
Well, I don't know what it is, so I'm going to have to say yes cross my fingers.
Gummyboot9 on Twitter says that you, meaning you and I, Catherine, accompanied this person to the allotment today and helped me clear the weeds of a week's holiday. That's how I listen to the tennis.
It's Gummyboot. Allotments have become really trendy in London recently. You can't get one for love nor money. There's like a sort of 3-year waiting list for an allotment in London.
I don't even really know what one is.
It's a garden that isn't where a garden would normally be. It's a garden that's not attached to your house.
Oh, I've got a garden. Can I still have an allotment?
No, you've got a garden, so you don't need an allotment.
Oh, all right.
Don't be greedy.
Right.
Can I throw you any more curveballs before we wrap up this podcast? You predicted Zverev and Svitolina, so nothing interesting there. You're predicting Federer to Federer to pull out of Cincinnati?
Yes, absolutely.
And therefore Nadal to get the number one spot?
I am.
Will Murray play the US Open?
Yes.
Because, of course, he's pulled out of Cincinnati this week. Chilich has also pulled out of Cincinnati.
Do you think Murray will play US Open?
Oh, I think it's 50-50 at best at the moment.
And that's why I hesitated. I think it's really in doubt.
I really think it's in the balance. I can't say better than 50-50, honestly.
So yes or no?
I'll go no. If you're going yes, I'll go no.
Right then.
Gosh, it's going to be interesting, US Open.
Oh, by the way, final thing. Do you know how you've been watching Athletics all?
Yeah. Yeah, I was going to introduce it as, hello, and you're listening to the Athletics podcast, brought to you in association with the tennis and with the Telegraph News Sport, because it's, my mind is mostly occupied with Athletics. Yes.
Yeah, well, my daughter was watching Usain Bolt. She says, I really like Usain Bolt. He's really cool.
She's discovered him at the wrong time.
Yeah, well, but she still thinks he's really cool, but not as cool as you, though, Daddy.
Right. Is the podcast becoming just a forum for just quoting other people's compliments about us? Well, quoting our family members' compliments about us?
Works for me.
Right.
It's fine by me.
Well, you've given me a platform now to start talking about the Athletics. I shed a little tear when Usain Bolt took to the track tonight.
Did you?
It was tough. And look, I won't go on too much, but if this week in Athletics has taught us anything, it's that there aren't any fairy tales in sport. And you can't take anything for granted. And I know that sounds like a massive cliche, but... it just seemed so, everybody totally took it for granted that Mo Farah would win double gold and Usain Bolt, even though he hasn't been in great form, would win individual gold in the 100 and would win the relay, and neither happened. And for me, as desperately sad as I found the whole thing, for me, it made me appreciate their greatness even more. It made me realise that it wasn't just a foregone conclusion all those years, and it wasn't just that they could rock up and win it because they were that much better than everybody. It made me realise how, not that I didn't know, but made me realise on a really gut level how much it took and how much of it not being a given that it was all those years, that they're great. And I think that applies across the board in sport to Djokovic. You know, his downfall over the past year or so, for me, puts into perspective what he did for those few years, and the fact that he held all the slams at the same time. You know, Federer's years in the wilderness, we've now gone to sort of taking him for granted again, haven't we? But for a while there, his years in the wilderness, or relative wilderness, put into perspective everything that he did. Same goes for Nadal. And I think you get the point, and I've been able to mention Usain Bolt, so I'm happy.
Yeah, well, I couldn't agree more. I do think we take these people for granted because I think it's so, they make it look so easy. We don't.
That's
see
the problem,
the
isn't
stuff.
It? It's too easy to just write them off. And you've brought it up before. I was totally guilty of it with Roger Federer a decade ago, and you took me to task on it when we first met. And I just said, "Oh, it's too easy for him. He makes it look too easy. I can't relate to that." And you tried to explain to me that he is a human being and it's not too easy for him. He's made it look easy, but that's through immense hard work. And I get it now. I didn't then.
Was that Catherine Whittaker admitting she's wrong?
Yeah, not... yes. Yes. I'm wrong all the blooming time, David. Don't make that the narrative. Yeah, that's what people tune into the podcast for, to listen to us getting things wrong. Definitely to listen to your daughter getting things wrong. David Law in Being Cooler Than Usain Bolt, shocker, said no one ever. This has been the Tennis Podcast, brought to you in association with The Telegraph and with Eurosport. We'll be back next week for our final podcast before our string of US Open daily podcasts begins. We will have no choice but to give you US Open predictions at some point in the near future, but not for the next week. So please, thanks for listening, and join us in a week.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.